So let's proceed. We're going to be talking today about the brain that's changing itself and the, let's see here, okay, neuroplasticity and the mind-brain connection and transformation. Are we aware that there are actually two hearts in the human body? This is surprising to some people. But actually, we're talking about one heart, of course, that resides in the chest. This is the pump that we all are familiar with, pumping blood to all the body. You realize that, excuse me, the chest heart beats continually over 30 million times a year, 3 billion times in a lifetime. And in fact, it's some of the first fetal tissue that's identifiable with the naked eye, well before there's actually any blood in the circulatory system, we can see pulsatile tissue that's going to become the cardiac pump. If it stops for even a few seconds, we're going to pass out. And if it doesn't start back in a few minutes, we won't wake up. It's no wonder that data shows that Medicare spends more funding and more time on the heart than any other organ in the body. So there's another heart, however, that resides in the cranium rather than the chest. This is the frontal lobes of the brain. As the chest heart is continually beating, the brain heart is continually making new connections. If you've ever thought about how is it that so much information can be stored in the same amount of space? The size of the cranium of a child is minor difference from an older person, and yet millions of bits of information have been stored, and it's because the brain is continually making new connections. In fact, physiology shows us that about 25% of the cardiac output from the chest heart supplies the brain, and so it's a very high energy consuming. Medical science is now exploring this cranium, this labyrinth inside of our cranium, and unraveling the mysteries. We can now read with 90% accuracy our words even before we speak them. Still not able to read our thoughts. I say yet, because who knows what we may learn to do. But it's true. They are connected to the lobes on a human being words with 90% accuracy. My wife is a very practical woman, and she tells me, well, just wait a millisecond and you'll know exactly what I'm going to say. But humor aside, this is could be a wonderful advancement for those who have no voice box or no ability to speak. An example of the importance of the brain heart, cranium heart, is Phineas Gage. Many of you may be familiar with him. He's become quite famous or infamous because of an accident he had. Here's a picture taken of him. Looks like a soldier with a rifle, but if you look more closely, we see that what he's holding is actually a temper. And if we look more closely also, we'll see that it looks like he's winking, but actually his left eye is closed because it's missing. Phineas Gage lived in the 1800s, but here we have an article published just a few years ago in PLOS-1, where they are mapping the changes that took place in Phineas Gage's brain as a result of his accident. And you can see here the computer simulation looking at the connections that were destroyed. And why is this important? Because of the phenomena that happened to Phineas Gage as a result of his accident. What happened was his job was tamping the charges that were placed in the boreholes during civil engineering, where they were actually doing railroad building or highway building. And one day the unthinkable happened, where he was tamping the dirt over the charge, and the charge went off prematurely, and that tamping rod became a missile that went up through Phinehas' head, as simulated here in this red showing. And this is an actual photograph of his actual skull, by the way, which has been preserved because of this remarkable effect that happened to him. He was changed dramatically as a result of this accident. It didn't kill him. He didn't have an infection, but what happened was Phinehas Gage went from being a responsible citizen and supervisor of men to being a profligate. He was just a changed personality and character altogether. He ended up leaving his family and home and going to South America, spending his money, and just character completely transformed because of the disconnections from the frontal lobe that took place because of his accident. And it helped us to understand the critical importance of the frontal lobe as a center of executive function in the brain. There's another photograph from the article published in 2012. So as I said, he had a dramatic change in personality and character as a result of this destruction of the frontal lobe and the connections to it. So there are two hearts in the human body, one in the chest, one in the cranium, but we've all heard about these heart transplants. It's not even on the front page anymore when someone has a pump removed from the chest of one person and we put it into the chest of another person. It is literally a remarkable and amazing bit of surgery, but as I say, it's so common, we don't even think of it that way. But how about this? We're talking about a brain transplant. And the work is, serious work is being done moving forward with this idea. But before we get too excited about this, I'd like to ask you to think for a moment. Would you want to have a brain transplant if, in fact, it was possible? Someone else's brain in your body. Think about it. A heart transplant is a donated heart. But a brain transplant, that's more like a donated body. Someone else's brain put into our body. So I haven't actually met anyone that has told me they would be interested in having a brain transplant if it was possible. In fact, some folks say, well, maybe if we could somehow clone ourselves and have a spare brain. But if you know anything much about the way this works, even that would not be the same you. That would be a different individual. There's only one of us with each of our brains. So actually, it turns out that of the two hearts, the cranial heart is the most important. This is the one that, in fact, I would like to suggest that the reason people are willing to undergo the traumatic experience of a heart transplant, a chest heart transplant, is to keep the cranial heart going. We want to continue to have a cognitive existence, and that's why we're willing to replace the pump in our chest with someone else's, even though many times it requires immune suppression and other kinds of results as a result of having one's tissue in our body. So what we really need to do is not to replace the brain. We're not wanting to do that. We want to rewire the brain. We would like to update the wiring, shall we say. Well, I have good news for you. Neuroplasticity has discovered that, in fact, that's what's happening. So neuroplasticity, the science of neuroplasticity, has changed practically everything that we thought we knew about the brain. We had thought of it as hardwired, or in some cases, as here, a little humor, hardly wired. But most of what I'm going to be talking about here is drawn from the book and the research that's reported in Doige's book called The Brain That Changes Itself. That was on the bestseller list for quite some time. He has a second book on this topic, Brain Heals Itself, that's also quite remarkable. But most of what I'm talking about, I want to give credit to Brain Changes Itself. So as it turns out, the most valuable real estate in the universe is not really in Acapulco or Beverly Hills or even some future planet that we might colonize,
when we destroy this earth, but it's actually the brain cortex area. The surface area of the brain is sold to the highest bidder and used for whatever we are asking our brains to do. In other words, the rewiring of our brains is a continual ongoing function, just like rebuilding the surface on the freeways or the highways in our country where they're constantly repaving. Brain cortical area is being remapped for maximum efficiency to perform whatever we are using our brains to do. So, for example, if you take up piano playing and you've never played piano before, as you practice and require your brain to become more expert at playing the piano, the map of our brain between the cortex and motor neurons that connect to our muscles of our hands and the parts of our body that are used in this new function, in this case, piano playing, those maps are revised and refined continually. Most of this work that we're talking about actually was discovered from the work of Paul Bhaktivedanta, who was what we call a doctor. He was both an MD and a PhD. Here's a photo taken of him years ago. Unfortunately, Dr. Paul Bhaktivedanta is deceased, but he was known as the man who could connect anything to anything. And in fact, he was the one that NASA used to develop the ability of the astronaut's spacesuit to provide sensory perception so that they could actually perform tasks wearing this suit. If you think about it, the reason they wore these suits, wear them, is because of the lack of pressure. There's a vacuum in space, and so this suit has to be capable of maintaining an adequate pressure inside the suit to protect the human being. And when you have something that's capable of having that much pressure and sustaining that pressure, it's very difficult then for the fingers to have any sensory perception. So Dr. Bhaktivedanta is the one that helped to design the receptors for the suit so that it would be capable of transmitting a sense of touch and feel to the astronaut inside. Here's another picture of him at a conference. So let me just tell a little bit about the story as he shares it. So what happened was that his father, Pedro, after Paul's mother had died, Pedro's wife had died, he had a stroke. He was about 65 years of age, and that stroke left him with hemiparesis. Basically, he was paralyzed completely on one side. He was unable to walk or speak. And his son, he had two sons, Paul, we've talked about, and a younger brother, George. And his son, George, took care of him because at that time, Paul was in residency and there was no way that Paul had time to help with his father. So George, he went to live with his son, George. George was less busy. He was actually just a medical student. And I say that with tongue in cheek, he's still busy, but he did have more time than Paul. And so Pedro went to live with his father. And George says, the only model I had was how babies learn. So we played games, rolling a ball like children. And what he, George and his father, Pedro, did was they designed exercises to improve Pedro's motor function. And eventually, Pedro regained all functionality. He was able actually to go back to work as a professor in New York. And they were so excited at the improvement that had taken place in the apparently full recovery. They were excited and they made an agreement that when Pedro died, that they would have an autopsy and they would publish the results showing the ability for the brain to recover after a stroke, which was practically unheard of. In fact, the rest of that story, I'm sorry, So Pedro remarried and he taught for years. He retired and then he died 7 years later. And as agreed, Dr. Aguilar did an autopsy. And it revealed a massive area of brain had been destroyed by the stroke, and the tissue was still necrotic, still dead and useless, to their surprise. But what Paul Bacchirita realized then was that his father's recovery had not been the result of brain healing, tissue healing itself, but of remapping the functions that had been carried by a part of the brain that was destroyed. Those functions were remapped to the remaining good brain tissue. And at the time, this was in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, it was considered impossible. In fact, when he submitted with Dr. Aguilar, they submitted an article for publication about this. It was refused. It was considered, you know, they didn't know, the reviewers couldn't explain why, but they certainly knew that it was not that these functions had been mapped to a different part of the brain. The brain was considered at that time to be quite hardwired. So to explain this just a little bit, here's a little illustration of the parts of the brain and how we map them and understand them. But what we're talking about in this mapping is mapping that has to do with the cortex, the surface of the brain, and the mapping of specific connections to organs or parts of the body. And these maps are, we now have discovered through Paul Bacchirita and others, we now know that this mapping process is an ongoing process and constant. I want to give you an example here, a couple of patients that Bacchirita worked with. So it happens not only after a stroke, as happened with Paul's father, but it also happens in other cases. Here's back to this picture of Dr. Paul Bacchirita, and here's a picture of a lady that he worked with. Cheryl Slitz is her name. Cheryl had lost 95 to 100% of her vestibular brain functioning after taking the drug gentamicin. It's an antibiotic that we are learned in medical school has the unfortunate side effect that if not monitored properly, it can destroy the vestibular function, that part of the brain. And that's what happened to Cheryl. So when she lost this vestibular brain function, that's the part of the brain that basically reads and understands the ear canal that give us a sense of position in space. So she feels like she's constantly falling. In fact, she says even if she loses her balance, falls to the ground, she still feels like she's falling because her vestibular function is gone. And she has to use her eyesight to help her see how to stand. So she, if you turn the lights out or if she closes her eyes, she will fall. And so her movement is shaky and jerky, and she's mentally fatigued because she's busy always keeping her attention on the walls and the door lines and so on to see that she's standing erect and not falling over. So somehow Dr. Bacchirita was mentioned to Cheryl as perhaps someone that could help her. And indeed, Dr. Bacchirita built an accelerometer, which was a sort of like a helmet that he would put on Cheryl's head. And he used a tongue sensor, a similar approach that they used with the astronauts in the early days of that design, to provide feedback so that this little plate she would put on her tongue, and it would provide sensory input about from the accelerometer, so that if her head was moving in one direction, there would be a impulses on her tongue and of one certain pattern. If her head was moving in the other direction, it would be a different pattern. And the thing that's hard for us to comprehend until we experience it is that our brain quickly learns how to associate input with an experience. So she said initially she can feel this thing on her tongue, but after a while, it basically, she forgot all about the fact that there was anything on her tongue, and she began to be able to stand erect because her brain was getting the input from this helmet, this accelerometer. And in the story, she says, and then she couldn't help it. She would cry. She cried for joy because with wearing this thing, she could stand erect. She could think about other things. She could do things besides spend her entire energy just trying to stand. And what was really interesting was that after she had this device on, Cheryl would take it off and experience what she considered another miracle. And that was that for a short period of time, she could still function. She would still have the ability for her vestibular function to seem to work, even though she wasn't wearing the accelerometer. And what Dr. Bakarita had thought would happen and did was that this residual effect continued. And each time she wore the helmet and took it off, the residual effect was longer until finally that wonderful day happened that she did not need the helmet any longer. The residual effect became permanent. And of course, what we now know happened, at the time we did not understand this, but what we now know is happening is because of the continual remapping process, when Cheryl was wearing the helmet that was providing the input from that was basically duplicating or paralleling the input from her ear canal, that function was being remapped to functional brain surface area. And so the vestibular function that Cheryl had lost was mapped to a different part of her brain, and she was in fact cured of this gentamicin poisoning. It was in fact the first and only time up to that point that such a thing had ever happened. And here's a little simple illustration of the homunculus, which is a more crude, with less resolution, a map where we often map parts of the body to the cortex. But the brain maps we're talking about are much more high resolution than these, than the homunculus itself. But it's a similar idea. So I'll now tell a little research story. This is a picture of the most common form of syndactyly. That syndactyly is when we have webbed or fused digits. And the most common one actually is the second and third toe on the foot. And typically this is not a problem at all. In fact, it may not even be corrected. However, syndactyly involving fingers is much more serious loss of function. And so those are almost always separated early in life so that web hand digits are definitely fixed, whereas the foot may not be. Well, researchers realized that this correction, this separation of digits was a wonderful natural opportunity for a study to learn more about this brain mapping. Because when they would map the brain of someone that had this syndactyly that had not been separated, there would actually only be a total of 4 digits mapped to the brain. But after the syndactyly, the fingers, the digits were separated, as is shown here in the right-hand side, after the surgery, there would, within a matter of weeks, days to weeks, there would be 5 digits mapped to the brain. And so many experiments of this type have helped us to understand how this takes place, how long it takes, what kind of things can be done to speed the process up, etc. We're not going to go into a lot of that depth, but what we can see is clearly that neuroplasticity changes everything that we thought we understood about the brain. In fact, almost nothing in the brain is hardwired, and we say almost with a question mark quite seriously, because at this point, there's no guarantee that anything is hardwired. There are definitely some things that are easily being rewired. Other functions, we haven't seen examples yet, but most of the experts believe and think that probably entire brain connections are flexible. They're plastic. They're capable of being rewired. A key concept that comes out of research in this field is called neurons that fire together, wire together. So what this means is that when, like with Cheryl, with the wearing the accelerometer, the sensations coming from through the tongue from the accelerometer were providing a pattern because similar input was coming from the ear canals as was coming from the accelerometer helmet, but they were not mapped. So as the brain began to have a pattern, if you will, a way to know how to wire them and how to read them, a map was created or recreated, we might say, from the ear canals to a viable cortex. And soon, as I shared, I don't remember the number of weeks or months that this took, but I know it was a number of weeks or months that Cheryl had to wear the helmet and then she would go home and she'd come back and so forth. It took time, but eventually a map was formed from her ear canal input to her brain. And the way that worked was neurons that fire together, meaning they have stimulation, they wire together. And so that's why when two digits are webbed or are attached, and they've done this in animals where they've artificially sewed digits together and looked at the maps on the brain and then removed the stitches and separated them and see that they can indeed control the number of digits being mapped, because those two digits, when they tightly connected, there's no difference in the neuron firing. The firing of one digit causes the same kind of action in the other one. And that's the reason for this. We also have learned that an experience-rich environment stimulates the brain to develop more robustly and to have greater neuroplasticity for our advantage is for the rewiring, and it takes less time to remap if there's a loss of tissue for a microinfarct, anything that would destroy brain tissue. Ideally, what we want is we want to be able to remap that as quickly as possible. I want to, I'll come back to this in a minute about mapping after a stroke. So here's another principle that they've learned is that, all right, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you again. Thank you.
All right, let me see. Is my screen, I'm not sure what happened. Let me share my screen.
Just reshare.
Yes. Are we able to see my screen again?
Yes, we are. Thank you.
Okay. My apologies. That could have been on my end. I'm not sure where, because I am having to use Wi-Fi. So the weaknesses, what I was saying is weaknesses can be overcome with proper strengthening exercises. And what we first started off was the learning that, talking about physical weakness, talking about like, say, a stroke that left weakness in a limb. And it was realized that with adequate strengthening exercises that would basically, you have to make that limb that's weak, you have to use it. You cannot say, well, I guess I'll never be able to use this again and put it in a sling. It will not remap. But if you tax that limb, if you will to use it, if you try to do things with it, like with Pedro when his son George had him doing crawling exercises, what was happening, what we now understand is that moving those limbs that have lost connection, the movement stimulates the brain to say, hey, there's input here, I need to map it to the cortex. And that's gotten even more sophisticated now to where we are learning how to correct other weaknesses. Dr. Deutsch tells in his book, The Brain That Changes Itself, some amazing stories about children with learning disabilities, children with autistic spectrum phenomena, that with the proper kind of sequential strength building exercises, many of these they've now been able to computerize. There's a program called Fast Forward that is scientifically shown to be able to improve learning disability, reading dyslexia, etc. And it's, while that's not the topic of my talk today, it is something well worth looking in the literature about. If you are a provider of care to such people, adults or children, you should check this out. Because, but where I do want to talk about is, I want to talk about post-stroke, because almost every one of us knows someone, even a relative, who has suffered from a stroke. And typically what is done is the subject or the patient or the victim, however we want to look at it, the person that's had the stroke receives intensive physical therapy and maybe occupational therapy for a while, and they recover some function. And the normal approach is to say, okay, after 6 or 8 weeks, maybe if we're fortunate, 10 or 12 weeks of intensive therapy, we'll say, well, that's about it. That's all the function you're going to get. And so they'll teach you how to use devices to allow you. I mean, some people need a wheelchair. Some people need these grippers that they can reach with, et cetera. But we now know that that isn't the optimal approach. In fact, Dr. Taub has a center in Texas that is becoming much renowned for the recovery that he has. People who've had stroke and been paralyzed for more than 20 years can go through his restraint therapy program and recover some completely, all improve, and some regain complete function of limbs that they thought were paralyzed for 20 years. And what he does is, it's called restraint therapy, not because he restrains the weak limb, he actually restrains the good limb and causes, forces the patient to try to use the paralyzed limb. And that's the thing that's so important. Neurons that fire together, wire together, and we've got to move that limb. And even if we move it with our good hand, we need to move it, and it will, over time, be stimulating the wiring process so that that limb, as long as the muscle function and the neurons in the limb are good, haven't been damaged, that limb can recover completely. And so it's never too late to improve and strengthen the brain. And of course, I make a never. Did I say never? The point is, as I said, after more than 20 years of living with paralysis, people are having recovery. And that's because of neuroplasticity and the fact that that neuroplasticity is there as long as there is functioning brain, cortex, and a limb or an organ with neurons. So what are some of the principles that we know for making rewiring of our brains more effective, more robust? One of the things that we've just learned is that rewiring requires focused attention. In other words, if I want to rewire my vestibular function like Cheryl, they found that Cheryl needed to wear that helmet for at least an hour and focus on, in other words, it takes attention, not, if our attention is not focused on the thing that we're trying to do, or again, after a stroke, you have to, the restraint sessions need to be an hour long for maximum rapidity of remapping. So anyway, 69 minutes most days of the week is what the minimum required for really robust rewiring. Another thing is, and we're talking here about improving general plasticity of our brains to make the global rewiring functions stronger, or as strong as it can be, is learning. So rewiring requires doing new things. So if I want to strengthen or exercise, say, the rewiring function of my brain, I want to take on learning something new, not just practice what I've already done, because it's true, but practicing what we've already done, it does refine the brain map, but it does not rewire anything. And so what we want to do is take on learning a new language. I don't know, some people say we ought to all be learning Chinese, maybe a new game. I remember when I first came across the Sudoku, I thought that was fun, and I've enjoyed it actually more than word puzzles, or take on a new career. In this day and time, maybe that's even more practical. Many of us are finding that we've lost our jobs and, for a variety of reasons. COVID-19 might be one of them. But the point is, for maximum strengthening of the rewiring function that we have, innate function we have, we want to strengthen it. We want to take on new things, learn something new, learn a new hobby, learn a new language. Another interesting thing that the research has discovered is the importance of sleep. Most of us are aware, some perhaps not, that sleep is so important for consolidating memory and learning. But it also is important for the rewiring function that's taking place in the brain. And I guess we could say that rewiring is a form or a type of learning. So it makes sense that we need to do this. So during sleep, one of the important things that happens is information is moved from the hippocampal area of the brain to the cortex, where it is a more permanent and more dense storage form. And it frees up the hippocampus portion of the brain for the new days, a new day of learning. Another thing is nutrition. We need to have optimal nutrition, actually, if we want to have the most robust rewiring function in our brain. So we're talking here both food that for nutrition, as well as positive thinking. Thinking is also a type of food for the brain. We need to learn to not have negative self-talk. Certainly I grew up this way. I know most of my friends, professional colleagues, etc., I've ever talked with, have, most of us, unfortunately, got quite a bit of negative talk when we were growing up. And we have a tendency to be hard on ourselves. In fact, I was having that experience running late today and realizing I had missed the time because of being in Central Time Zone instead of my usual Eastern Time Zone. And I was tempted to berate myself, but that doesn't help my performance at all. And so over time, I've learned that you can change your self-talk, my friends. And if you don't know this, you need to know this, because it can make a dramatic difference. You can say to yourself, no, I am not going to indulge that negative self-talk. I am going to feed myself with positive self-talk. I can do this, and I know how to do this, and I'll do a good job at it. So that's part of the food that they've discovered, is that self-talk has a lot to do with the functionality and the efficiency of our brain and its rewiring. Here's one that's very interesting, clear conscience. In other words, what we're talking about here is a sense of guilt or of something that we feel we should have done. Maybe I owe someone something, or I promised a favor, or even whatever it might be, or maybe as a Christian, I feel that I have sinned against my religion, my beliefs. This creates a noise, if you want to think of it that way. It's sort of like distractive function. And we need to get things right. If I've done something wrong, I need to apologize to my spouse about, I need to make that apology, get it right, fix it to the extent I can, and move on. And there's clear, there's been evidence from the research showing that this is a part of having the most robust rewiring function. We need to be hopeful and have a hopeful, guilt-free mind. And then, of course, optimal circulation and oxygenation of the blood that's supplying the brain. So, you know, we're talking here about, of course, the cardiovascular system, because that's the system that brings the blood, and then the pulmonary is the oxygenation. So cardiopulmonary exercise, we need to be have good fitness. We're not saying you have to be a long-distance athlete, but we need to have better fitness than the average American is getting these days. Too much sitting, too much not an adequate aerobic exercise. And that concludes the presentation.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.